averaged more than $6, or more than personal care and furniture put together. A quart of milk went for 6 cents, a pound of pork for nearly 17 cents, and a pound of rice for 8 cents. For entertainment, a good wrestling match in South Carolina cost 25 cents, and a New York opera ticket to Die Meistersinger cost $1.50. A working woman earned about $365 a year, and she spent $55 on clothes, $78 on food, and $208 on room and board. Consider the example of Mary Keneally, an unmarried Irish-American clerk in Boston who made $7 a week, plus commissions, and shared a bedroom with one of the children in the family she boarded with. The family of seven, headed by a loom repairman, earned just over $1,000 a year and had a five-room house with no electricity or running water. At work, Keneally was not permitted to sit. She put in 12 to 16 hours a day during a holiday season. Although more than 80% of the clerks were women, they were managed by men, who trusted them implicitly. One executive said, "We never had but four dishonest girls, and we've had to discharge over 40 boys in the same time. Boys smoke and lose at cards," the manager dourly noted. Timeline: 1896, McKinley elected. 1898, Spanish-American War, Hawaii annexed. Open door note. 1900, McKinley re-elected. 1901, McKinley assassinated. Theodore Roosevelt becomes president. 1902, Northern Securities suit. Newlands Reclamation Act. 1903, acquisition of Panama Canal Zone. Roosevelt corollary delivered. 1904, Roosevelt elected president. 1908, Taft elected president. 1909-11, Ballinger-Pinchot controversy. 1911, Standard Oil Supreme Court decision. 1912, Roosevelt forms Bull Moose Progressive Party. Wilson elected president. Until 1900, employees like Keneally usually took electric trolleys to work, although Boston opened the first subway in the United States in 1898, and low-paid workers could enjoy the many public parks. Boston was among the nation's leaders in playground and park space. Bicycles, though available, remained expensive, about $100 or more than a quarter of a year's wage for someone like Keneally. And thus, most people still depended on either city transportation or their own feet to get them to work. Nevertheless, the economic progress was astonishing. Here were working-class women whose wages and lifestyle exceeded that of most European men by the end of Teddy Roosevelt's second term. The improvement in the living conditions of average Americans was so overwhelming that even one of the godfathers of communism, Leon Trotsky, who lived in New York City just a few years later in 1917, recalled, "We rented an apartment in a workers' district and furnished it on the installment plan. That apartment at $18 a month was equipped with all sorts of conveniences that we Europeans were quite unused to. Electric lights, gas cooking range, bath, telephone, automatic service elevator, and even a chute for the garbage." This prosperity baffled socialists like the German August Bebel, who predicted in 1907, "Americans will be the first to usher in a socialist republic." Yet by the 21st century, two historians of socialism in America concluded, "No socialist candidate has ever become a vehicle for major protest in the United States." The prosperity that short-circuited the socialists and dumbfounded the communists was the end product of a 30-year spurt, marred only by the two panics. During that burst, American steel producers climbed atop world markets. National wealth doubled in the 1890s, and in 1892 the United States attained a favorable balance of trade. By 1908, American investments overseas reached $2.5 billion and would soar to $3.5 billion in less than a decade. The president of the American Bankers Association boasted in 1898, "We hold three of the winning cards in the game of commercial greatness to win: iron, steel, and coal." With excesses both outrageous and mesmerizing, the Gilded Age concealed a widespread prosperity generated by the most amazing engine of growth ever seen. The number of patents, which passed the 1 million mark in 1911, rewarded invention and innovation. Brilliant engineers like Carnegie's Julian Kennedy had more than half of his 100 patents in actual operation in Carnegie's steel mills during his lifetime. American innovation enabled factory workers to maintain rising real wages, enabled agriculture to consistently expand production, and generated enough wealth that waves of immigrants came in and kept on coming. It was something Upton Sinclair's The Jungle could not explain. If things were so bad, why did people so desperately try to get here? Professionalism and scientific became the buzzwords of the day. To many, science had become the new god, and the theories of Darwin, Freud, and Marx convinced people that only those things one could prove through experimentation were valid, despite the fact that Darwin, Marx, or Freud had never proven anything scientifically. Even Roosevelt, usually level-headed if somewhat impulsive, called for scientific management of the tariff. Although Frederick W. Taylor did not introduce his concepts of labor effectiveness until 1915, when he wrote Principles of Scientific Management, the Bible of Productivity Studies, he had already perfected his practices at Midvale Steel Company. Everywhere, however, science and professionalism were mated to the reform impulse to convince the people that a solution existed to all problems. Two of the most prominent writers of the day, Walter Lippmann and William James, contributed to the broadening consensus that man was in control. Lippmann, publishing Drift and Mastery in 1914, celebrated the introduction of scientific discipline into human affairs. As his title implied, all previous human history had been drift until saved by the planners. James, who wrote Principles of Psychology, 1890, and The Will to Believe, 1897, introduced the philosophy of pragmatism, in which man controlled his own fate. Truth happens to an idea, James argued in Pragmatism, 1907. It becomes true, is made true by events. It was deliciously ironic. By his own definition, James invented the truth of pragmatism. James shared with Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson the progressive view that government should reside in the hands of true men and trusted reformers who could focus their battle instinct on the social issues of the day. Like Roosevelt's, James's father had come from wealth, providing the time and leisure to denounce Americans' worship of the bitch goddess success, even though he obsessively pursued money himself. William James absorbed his father's writings. Henry James worked for Brook Farm founder George Ripley. He also was exposed to the ideas of European intellectuals he met on trips to the continent. After settling on psychology as a field, the young man expressed an interest in studying ghosts, second sight, spiritualism, and all sorts of hobgoblins. Yet despite his thirst for God and his fascination with the supernatural, he steadily moved further away from spirituality, seeking to satisfy the urgent demand of common sense. The result was his Principles of Psychology, which addressed issues of personal consciousness, the expression of one's self to others, and of the necessity for action causing experiences in the direction of habits you aspire to gain. James's famous Pragmatism, 1907, was the culmination of his attempt to link human action to eternal dispositions. beliefs, he maintained, were really rules for action, which often led him to support social reform and to oppose the war in the Philippines. On the other end of the spectrum of religious spiritual thought in the late 1800s came a new wave of cults that spread through the nation under the auspices of Christianity, all well outside the mainstream of traditional biblical teachings. Mary Baker Eddy's Christian Science thrived during this era, as did other mind-cure New Thought doctrines that incorporated pseudo-witchcraft practices, like Eddy's malicious animal magnetism, whereby a follower could inflict occult harm on others at a distance. Theosophy, with overtones of Hinduism and Asian mysticism, also surged at this time. Perhaps the most rapidly growing sect, started by Charles Taze Russell, was the Watchtower Bible Society, otherwise known as the Jehovah's Witnesses. Russell had come out of Adventist influences, but diverted sharply from the teachings of Ellen White to claim that God had two sons, Jesus and Lucifer. A virtual who's who of mystical and religious figures were born between 1874 and 1890, including Harry Houdini, Aleister Crowley, Edgar Cayce, Father Divine, Amy Semple McPherson, and H.P. Lovecraft. They reflected a continued trend away from the intellectual and academic search for God posed by thinkers like James. Yet the nature of their ideas necessarily tended to cut them off from mainstream social action through government. Indeed, rather than attracting the emotional, esoteric followers who gravitated to Father Divine and Mary Baker Eddy, the progressives found a legion of willing allies in a different camp: journalists. After all, journalism had once been the home of religious newspapers, and a few of the sect newspapers not only survived, but flourished, including the Christian Science Monitor. In general, journalism had secularized at a shocking rate by the late 1800s. The separation of fact from partisanship had imposed on newspapers a little understood requirement that they also cleave fact from values. So journalism returned to the notions of science, planning, and human control already prevailing in government and business. Typical of the new journalistic progressives was Walter Lippmann. A former socialist, indeed the founder of the Harvard Socialist Club, Lippmann served as Lincoln Steffens's secretary. By the early 1900s, however, he had abandoned his socialism in favor of more moderate progressivism, supporting Teddy Roosevelt in 1912. Despite many similarities in their views, Lippmann and James came from different eras. Lippmann's generation came on the tail end of the mystic boom and included Babe Ruth, born 1895, Sinclair Lewis, born 1885, Irving Berlin, born 1888, Al Capone, born 1899, and F. Scott Fitzgerald, born 1896. A generation straddled by wars, it differed significantly from William James's, whose earlier generation included William McKinley, Woodrow Wilson, Frederick Taylor, and Booker T. Washington. Lippmann and James did share a certain relativistic belief that no value could exist for long. Whatever proved effective today would still be subject to time and place, and therefore not valid as eternal truth. Intellectuals may have bought the new pragmatism and secular scientific approach to life's challenges, but middle America had not. Jean-Pierre Godet, a Belgian immigrant in Cedar Falls, Iowa, reflected the turn-of-the-century faith that still gripped most Americans with this simple prayer: "Dear God, thanks for Cedar Falls and all 391 residents, and for this good piece of farmland 2 miles outside of town. From there, I can watch the rest of the people with a little perspective. I'd like to learn to be like the best of them and avoid the bad habits of the worst of them. I'd like to pay off my bank mortgage as fast as I can and still have time to sit down with my neighbors. And if you don't mind, I think I'll keep the mortgage in the family Bible, to let you remind me that I have some debts to pay, while I remember that honesty is the never-ending rehearsal of those who want to be the friends of God and the 391 people in the good little section of the kingdom where we live. Citizens in Godet's little section of Cedar Falls exulted in sharing their freedom with others. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness could never be impositions or values foisted on unwilling recipients. Quite the contrary, they were the embodiment of Americanism. "I have fallen in love with American names," Stephen Vincent Benet once wrote, "the sharp names that never get fat, the snakeskin titles of mining claims, the plumed war bonnet of Medicine Hat, Tucson, and Deadwood, and Lost Mule Flat." The words of immigrants like Godet, "I love America for giving so many of us the right to dream a new dream," were as lost on the muckrakers as they were on many modern historians obsessed by class, race, and gender oppression. Yet they have never been lost on those who would lead. "An American," John F. Kennedy said decades later, "by nature is an optimist. He is experimental, an inventor and builder, who builds best when called upon to build greatly." Operating under such assumptions, overseas expansion, whether in Hawaii, Panama, or Cuba, could prove only beneficial to whatever people were assimilated. Consequently, the era of American imperialism could just as easily be relabeled the era of optimism. Emerging from the lingering effects of a depression, still healing from the ravages of the Civil War, and divided over a broad spectrum of issues, Americans nevertheless remained a people of vision and unselfishness. The liberties they enjoyed belonged by right, they thought, to everyone. If manifest destiny itself was dead, the concept of an American presence in the world, of Americans who build greatly, had only just started. Major McKinley. Save Cleveland, few American politicians have so consistently upheld high standards of personal character and yet at the same time so consistently been on the wrong side of important issues as William McKinley. Born in Niles, Ohio, 1843, and raised in Poland, Ohio, McKinley absorbed a sense of spiritual design for his life from his Methodist mother. In this, he resembled Lincoln, convinced that God had important plans for his life, and he professed his Christian faith at age 16. He also inherited from his mother a strong abolitionist sentiment and a commitment to the Union. When the Civil War came, McKinley was working in his hometown, but he quickly joined the Ohio Volunteer Infantry Regiment under the then-major Rutherford B. Hayes, whom he greatly admired. "Application, not brilliance, carried him," remarked his biographer, and certainly McKinley displayed an appreciation for doing the little things right. When opportunity came, he literally grabbed it by the reins. Assigned to commissary duty at the Battle of Antietam, McKinley grew concerned about his regiment, which had left at daybreak, when he saw stragglers returning to camp. Reasoning that his comrades were probably under fire and without supplies, he organized a group of wagons, one of which he drove himself, to carry food, coffee, and other supplies to the front. Racing the horses through the blizzard of musket and cannon fire, McKinley provided welcome rations to his regiment, earning him a battlefield promotion to lieutenant. Before the end of the war, he was further promoted to captain, then major. Hence, he remained, from that time on, Major McKinley to his friends and admirers. Returning to Ohio after the war, McKinley met his wife, Ida. Like Lemonade Lucy Hayes, an ardent prohibitionist, further instilling in him another progressive notion that had started to influence many of the intellectuals and politicians of the day. Self-effacing, genuinely unaffected by money and its lures, and deeply committed to his sickly wife, McKinley went into law in Canton, where his penchant for taking cases from groups other lawyers often ignored, like the Masons and Catholics, attracted the attention of the Republican Party. He won a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives in 1876, joining such future political notables as Joe Cannon and James Garfield, alongside a Senate class that featured James G. Blaine, Roscoe Conkling, and Lucius Quincy Lamar. In the House, McKinley fought tenaciously for the protective tariff, opposing the tariff for revenue only crowd. The major was convinced that tariffs protected laborers and brought prosperity for all. Only after he had won the presidency and had to deal with the reciprocity of trade with Canada did McKinley begin to appreciate the value of free and open trade. He was equally committed to sound money, although he entertained arguments for bimetallism as long as silver's value remained fixed to gold. His friendship with his old military superior, Rutherford Hayes, grew while Hayes was in the White House, and the McKinleys were frequent dinner guests. McKinley and fellow Ohioan John Sherman, with whom he disagreed sharply over silver, escorted Chester Arthur to his congressional address following the assassination of Garfield. By 1890, after guiding a new protective tariff, the McKinley Tariff, through the House, the major had arrived on the national stage. Nevertheless, local district politics led to his defeat that year for the House, after which he promptly was elected governor of Ohio. In sum, McKinley paid his dues and greased his own skids. Although a McKinley presidential boomlet had occurred in 1892, it was not yet his time. In 1896, however, he was ready for a full run at the White House, aided by Marcus A. Hanna, his political mentor. Mounting a front porch campaign in which people literally traveled to his house to hear his ideas, McKinley spoke to 750,000 people from 30 states. His denuded yard, trampled over by so many feet, became a sea of mud in the rain. But his work was effective, and the lag between William Jennings Bryan's burst of energy following the Cross of Gold speech and the election provided just enough cushion for the Republican to win. The closeness of the electoral vote, 271 to 176, and the popular vote, 7.1 million to 6.5 million, between two candidates with such strikingly opposite views, reflected the sharp divisions within the country over the money question, the tariff, and, most recently, the Depression and its cures. McKinley did not get a single electoral vote south of the Mason-Dixon line, and only won California, North Dakota, Iowa, and Oregon out of the entire West. Nevertheless, political scientists have long considered the election of 1896 a critical realignment, in that pro-Republican voters remained a solid bloc for the next 26 years. This bloc would elect one Republican president after another, interrupted only by the 1912 election, in which two Republicans split the vote and allowed Woodrow Wilson to win. Not only would Minnesota, Iowa, and Oregon generally remain in the Republican column, but in 1900, McKinley would add South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Wyoming, Utah, and Washington after the realignment. 4 years later, in 1904, Republicans added Idaho, Nevada, and Colorado, giving them not only the solid North, but also the entire West, except for the former Confederate state of Texas. Only when Teddy Roosevelt stepped down did the Democrats again recover momentum in the West. At first, however, such a massive shift was not obvious in the conduct of the new administration. McKinley impressed no one after naming his cabinet. "A fine old hospital," Henry Adams remarked. The last president to write his own speeches, or at least dictate them, McKinley won no accolades for inspirational rhetoric. And, as a committed husband to an ailing wife, McKinley hardly fed the social appetites of the Washington elites. Ida McKinley spent her days secluded in her room, entirely miserable. When in public, she was prone to seizures and fainting, perhaps an undiagnosed narcolepsy. A platoon of doctors, legitimate and quacks, never managed to control her condition. Yet the major could continue a conversation right through one of Ida's seizures as though nothing had happened. Foreign affairs crept into the spotlight during McKinley's term, particularly American dealings with Hawaii and Cuba. Harrison and Cleveland had left the Hawaiian problem unsettled. Located 2,000 miles west of California, the Hawaiian Islands, also called the Sandwich Islands, had played host to American sailors, traders, and missionaries in the 1800s. Rich in sugar, fruit, and other products, the United States had extended tariff favors to Hawaii, often dominating the island's economies. In 1893, with tacit U.S. support, Republican forces on the islands staged a rebellion against Queen Liliuokalani, who had gained the throne 2 years earlier when David Kalakaua, her brother, died. Liliuokalani inherited charges of corruption, including special favors to sugar magnate Klaus Spreckels. Her brother had also repealed laws prohibiting sales of liquor and opium to Hawaiians. An anti-monarchy movement spearheaded by the Reform Party forced Kalakaua to sign the Bayonet Constitution in 1887, so named because it was signed under threat of an armed uprising. The Constitution gave foreigners the right to vote. When Liliuokalani ascended to the throne, ostensibly to maintain and protect the Constitution, she immediately sought to overthrow it. Thus, the rebellion of 1893, while certainly supported by whites, was a response to the Queen's poor judgment as much as it was an American plot. The new government sent a treaty of annexation to Washington, but the lame duck Harrison forwarded it to the Senate. When the anti-expansionist Cleveland came into office, he dispatched a team to Hawaii to determine if the revolution was genuine or an American-contrived plot. Based on its findings, Cleveland concluded that the latter was the case. He determined that, although Liliuokalani had indeed planned to elevate herself again above the Constitution, a group of 18 Hawaiians, including some sugar farmers, with the aid of U.S. Marines, had overthrown her and named themselves as a provisional government. What is often missed is at least one earlier attempt by Hawaii to become a part of the United States. In 1851, King Kamehameha III had secretly asked the United States to annex Hawaii, but Secretary of State Daniel Webster declined, saying, "No power ought to take possession of the islands as a conquest or colonization." Webster, preoccupied by slavery, was unwilling to set a precedent that might allow more slave territory into the Union. By the time the issue reached McKinley's desk, another concern complicated the Hawaiian question. Japan. The Empire of Japan had started to assert itself in the Pacific, and, seeing Hawaii as a threat to her sphere of interest, sent warships to Hawaii and encouraged emigration there. This greatly troubled Theodore Roosevelt, among others, who energetically warned Americans that they could not allow Japan to claim the islands. McKinley, in private, agreed with Roosevelt, though he was coy when it came to stating so publicly. Before he assumed office, McKinley had told representatives from Hawaii, "Of course I have my ideas about Hawaii, but consider that it best at the present time not to make known what my policy is." Nevertheless, once in office, he pointed out that if nothing was done, there will be before long another revolution, and Japan will get control. "We cannot let those islands go to Japan," McKinley bluntly told Senator George Hoar. Indeed, it was Hawaii herself that, in June 1897, refused to admit a new contingent of Japanese laborers, prompting a visit from Imperial warships. And it was not big business that supported Hawaiian annexation. Quite the contrary, the Western sugar beet interests opposed the infusion of Hawaiian cane sugar. At the same time, McKinley knew that an annexation treaty likely lacked the two-thirds Senate majority to pass, since most of the Southern Democrats disliked the notion of bringing in as citizens more Asians and brown-skinned Hawaiians. Therefore, to avoid dealing with the insufficient Senate majority, the Republicans introduced a joint resolution to annex Hawaii apart from the original, withdrawn treaty. On July 7, 1898, McKinley, following Polk's example with Texas, signed the joint resolution of Congress annexing the Hawaiian Islands. Cuba Libre. A far more difficult problem that McKinley had inherited was a growing tension with Spain over Cuba. A Spanish possession, Cuba lay only 90 miles off the coast of Florida. At one time, it had been both gatekeeper and custom house for Spain's New World Empire, but like Spain herself, Cuba had lost influence. The Cubans desired freedom and autonomy, as illustrated by one revolt that lasted from 1868 to 1878, and another that erupted in 1895, all suppressed by the 160,000 Spanish soldiers on the island. General Valeriano Weyler, who governed the island, had a reputation for unusual cruelty, leading to his nickname, the Butcher. For 40 years, the United States had entertained notions of purchasing Cuba, but Spain had no intention of selling, and the installation of Weyler sounded a requiem for negotiations to acquire the Pearl of the Antilles. American concerns were threefold. First, there was the political component, in which Americans sympathized with the Cubans' yearning for independence. Second, businessmen had important interests on the island, cultivated over several decades. Sugar, railroads, shipping, and other enterprises gave the United States an undeniable economic interest in Cuba, while at the same time putting Americans in a potential crossfire. Third, there was the moral issue of Weyler's treatment of the Cubans, which appealed to American humanitarianism. It might have ended at that, with Americans expressing their support for the rebels from afar, if not for the efforts of two newspaper men, Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst. Pulitzer, an Austro-Hungarian immigrant, had worked as a mule driver before being recruited by Carl Schurz to write for a German-language daily. A radical Missouri Republican, Pulitzer had purchased the St. Louis Post and Dispatch newspapers, using them as a base for the reformist agenda that included issues of prohibition, tax fraud, and gambling. His most important acquisition, however, the New York World, emphasized sensation, scandal, and human interest stories. For all of its innovation and success, the New York World remains best known for a color supplement it started to run in 1896 on cheap yellow paper, featuring a cartoon character known as the Yellow Kid, which led to the phrase Yellow Press. Hearst, born to California millionaire rancher George Hearst, obtained the San Francisco Examiner to satisfy a gambling debt. He admired Pulitzer and tailored the Examiner to resemble Pulitzer's paper. Emphasizing investigative reporting combined with reformism and sensationalism, Hearst employed the best writers he could find, including Ambrose Bierce, Stephen Crane, Mark Twain, and Jack London. Purchasing the New York Journal in 1895, Hearst became Pulitzer's competitor. The two men had much in common, though. Both saw the chaos and tragedy of Cuba purely in terms of expanded circulation. Cuban suffering advanced sales, but a war would be even better. Hearst assigned the brilliant artist Frederick Remington to Cuba to provide battle sketches well before any hostilities were announced. When Remington arrived in Cuba, he cabled back to Hearst that there was no war to illustrate. "You furnish the pictures," Hearst wired. "I'll furnish the war." Each publisher sought to outdo the other with Spanish horror stories, giving Weyler his nickname and referring to Cuba as a prison. Ironically, 80 years later, when Castro's Cuba genuinely became such a prison, no national newspaper dared call it as much. Nevertheless, the influence of the press in fomenting war has been overemphasized. Cuban expatriates had already circulated in major U.S. cities attempting to raise awareness and money. Moreover, mainstream papers such as the New York Times supported McKinley's caution. The role of business in beating the drums for war has also been exaggerated, since as many businesses opposed any support for the revolution as supported it. Prosperity had only recently returned to the nation, and industrialists wished to avoid any disruption of markets that war might bring. Certainly an intellectual case for war, embraced by Alfred Thayer Mahan, John Hay, and Roosevelt, needed no support from the yellow press. Their arguments combined the need for humanitarian relief for the suffering Cubans with the necessity for naval bases and eviction of old world powers from the Caribbean, as well as good old-fashioned expansionism. If the yellow press needed any help in furnishing the war, Spanish minister to Washington, Dupuis de Lôme, provided it with a letter he wrote in February 1897. De Lôme's letter ended up on a desk at the New York Journal, thanks to the Cuban rebels and their contacts in New York. And of course, the paper gleefully printed its contents with the headline, "Worst Insult to the United States in Its History." The minister called McKinley weak and a bidder for the admiration of the crowd, who played both sides of the war issue. He further announced his intention to propagandize among American senators and others in opposition to the junta. McKinley demanded a formal apology, and even though Spain generally agreed with American conditions, the Spanish delay in issuing the apology made them look belligerent. Nevertheless, it appeared relations might be restored, and as part of the reconciliation, McKinley dispatched the battleship USS Maine to make a courtesy call to Havana. At anchor in Havana, the Maine's presence seemed uncontroversial. Sailors routinely walked the streets, fraternizing with sailors of the Spanish Navy and purchasing Cuban goods to take home. On the evening of February 15, 1898, however, a massive explosion rocked the vessel, which slowly sank, killing 260 crewmen. News reached McKinley at 3 o'clock in the morning. Coming on the heels of the de Lôme letter, which had actually been written many months earlier, McKinley assumed that the two were linked, but he hoped to avoid a rush to war. He ordered an investigation of the explosion, knowing that a conclusion showing the blast had originated from the outside would tend to implicate Spain, although certainly the rebels had a stake in trying to involve the United States. Americans, however, already seemed convinced of Spain's complicity, and increasingly McKinley was viewed as blocking a necessary war. Although no proof was offered of Spain's culpability, not until 1910 did an official inquiry on the remains of the ship seem to confirm that the explosion was caused by a mine, but several subsequent investigations, while not completely ruling out a mine, point to a coal bunker fire. On April 20, 1898, Congress handed McKinley a war resolution along with the Teller Amendment to liberate Cuba within 5 years of occupation. Although the subsequent Platt Amendment of 1903 placed some limitations on Cuban action, including a required lease of a naval station at Guantanamo Bay, the essence of the Teller Amendment's mandatory withdrawal of American forces remained highly unusual in world history. For those historians who claimed the United States desired an empire, American behavior was odd. What other empires legally bind themselves to abandoning conquered lands the instant they acquire them? Spain's sudden conciliatory attitude notwithstanding, the pieces fit too conveniently for many Americans to arrive at any other conclusion than that the Spanish were responsible for the sinking of the Maine. From Spain, it was much too little too late, and for the United States, it was another opportunity to teach the pompous European state a lesson. On April 21st, the Spanish severed diplomatic ties. 4 days later, Congress declared war. Just as the world powers had fully expected Mexico to easily defeat the United States in the Mexican War, Europeans again overestimated the decrepit Spanish Empire's strengths and virtually ignored American technology and resolve. The U.S. Army was small and largely untrained. Many units were volunteers. Those who had fighting experience came from the frontier, where the Sioux and the Apache presented much different challenges than the more conventional Spanish foe. McKinley made plans to gather the forces at Tampa and other Florida ports, then land at several points in Cuba. He called for 200,000 volunteers to expand the small 28,000-man army, and by the end of November 1898, 223,000 volunteers had swelled the ranks. These volunteers included the famous Theodore Roosevelt, who had resigned his position as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and his Rough Riders, an assortment of Indians and scouts, miners and marauders, and even the famous Prescott, Arizona lawman Bucky O'Neill. But the regiment also included James Robb Church, a star football player at Princeton, New York socialite Hamilton Fish, and the cream of Harvard and Yale. Everyone wanted to join, including the creator of the famous Tarzan series, Edgar Rice Burroughs, whom Roosevelt rejected. Equipping and transporting this army of volunteers was a difficult matter. A new Krag 308 rifle that fired smokeless shells was available, but few units had it, and even then it was inferior to the German Mausers used by the Spaniards. Troops called the poor food they received embalmed beef, and the atrocious state of medical facilities contributed to the deaths of 2,565 men from disease, more than seven times the 345 men who died in combat. The Rough Riders found they could not even take their horses to Cuba. For good or ill, though, one thing was certain: the press would cover this war. Hearst had seen to that. In addition to Remington with his sketchbooks, author Stephen Crane, whose Civil War tale, The Red Badge of Courage, 1895, had already become a classic, traveled with the troops to Cuba. America may have trailed Spain in rifle quality and even the training of her ground forces, but the United States had a decided advantage at sea. There, the white cruisers Olympia, Boston, Raleigh, Concord, and Baltimore outranged and outgunned all of the Spanish vessels. Deploying the fleet to Hong Kong, however, was entirely Roosevelt's doing. He had given the order when the Secretary of the Navy had gone out of the office for a doctor's appointment. European observers, as always, underestimated Yankee capabilities. Commodore George Dewey, who headed the U.S. Asiatic Squadron, reported strong betting at the Hong Kong Club against the Americans, even at considerable odds. The American battle plan was sound, however. First, Roosevelt ordered Dewey's squadron to Hong Kong even before a declaration of war, in case hostilities broke out. In April, Dewey headed to sea, where he prepared for battle. Spain had seven vessels to Dewey's six in Manila Bay, but they were inferior, and their commander, Rear Admiral Patricio Passarón, knew it. Lined up in Manila Bay, Passarón, in a state of gloom, resigned himself to going down with guns blazing. After the declaration of war, Dewey and his ships repainted from white to black and gray camouflage and sailed for Manila Bay. Spanish guns fired first, prompting shouts of "Remember the Maine" from the American decks. But Dewey uttered his classic line, repeated afterward in countless cartoons, when he told the Olympia's captain, "You may fire when ready, Gridley." At a range of more than 5,000 yards outside the Spaniards' range, U.S. guns shattered the helpless Spanish ships. Dewey did not lose a single man. A two-pronged assault on Cuba was the second piece of the U.S. strategy, and it was aimed at forcing the Spanish Caribbean fleet to exit its port while American troops advanced overland to Havana. The grand assault was led by the 300-pound General William Shafter, whose forces landed on June 22nd at Dakari, unopposed and unscathed. The only U.S. casualties were 5 drowned horses. Ex-rebel General Joseph Wheeler, in his first encounter with Spanish troops, shouted, "We've got the damned Yankees on the run!" But his men knew what he meant, and they proceeded to link up with Shafter's forces. By that time, Shafter had fallen ill to the point where he was unable to ride. After driving the Spaniards out of several positions, American troops converged on the main target, San Juan Heights. Faced with 2 hills, San Juan and Kettle, Leonard Wood's regiments, including the Rough Riders, whose horses were still back in Tampa, and Lieutenant John J. Pershing's 10th Cavalry Buffalo soldiers, crossed the river in front of Kettle Hill. Organizing both the regiments, Teddy Roosevelt, a mounted sitting target, spurred his horse Little Texas in front of his men charging on foot. The units storming Kettle Hill raised a cheer from the American forces still pinned under fire below San Juan Heights. Spanish positions on San Juan Heights still proved impenetrable until a courageous captain, G.S. Grimes, drove 3 batteries of Gatling guns to within 600 yards of the Spanish lines and poured fire at them. Remington captured the moment in a memorable painting. That was enough to spark the actual charge up San Juan Hill. Roosevelt had already led his men up Kettle Hill and was not among those advancing on San Juan's positions, and the charge was an orderly, steady advance into heavy fire. At the same time, Roosevelt's Rough Riders, pouring machine gun fire into the Spanish flank, charged down the mild slope of Kettle Hill directly into the Spanish positions. Spanish resistance disintegrated. Later, Pershing wrote his recollections of the attack. "White regiments, black regiments, regulars and Rough Riders, representing the young manhood of the North and the South, fought shoulder to shoulder, unmindful of race or color, unmindful of whether commanded by ex-Confederate or not, and mindful only of their common duty as Americans." The Spanish general, Joaquin Vara del Rey, had the gross misfortune of being shot through both legs. Then, as his men carried him on a stretcher to safety, he was hit again through the head. Roosevelt, recommended for a Medal of Honor for his actions by both commanding officers, Shafter and Wood, was denied the recognition by political enemies until January 2001, when Congress finally awarded it to him posthumously. Shafter, still battling gout and heat, now surrounded Santiago and squeezed Admiral Pascual Cervera's fleet out of the harbor, where it had to run the gauntlet of Admiral William Sampson's American vessels. On July 3, 1898, Cervera's fleet sailed out, much to the surprise of Sampson. The Spanish knew what awaited them. "Poor Spain," said a captain aboard the Teresa to Admiral Cervera. The sound of the ship bugles meant that Spain had become a nation of the fourth class. After a brief running battle with the far superior American ships, in which the U.S. Navy badly damaged all of Cervera's vessels, the Spanish fleet hauled down its colors. "The fleet under my command," telegraphed Admiral Sampson to Washington, "offers the nation, as a 4th of July present, the whole of Cervera's fleet." Spain quickly capitulated. Despite the loss of only 400 men in combat, the Spanish-American War had proven costly. The government had mobilized thousands of soldiers who never saw action, but who ultimately would draw pensions valued at $5 billion. At the end of 60 years, the pensions from the Spanish-American War still cost the United States $160 million annually. Final negotiations left the United States in control of the Philippines, Cuba, and Puerto Rico. The Senate had insisted that Cuba be free and not a U.S. possession, but the United States paid $20 million for Guam, the Philippines, and Puerto Rico. The disposition of these other territories, however, was not so clear. two other nations, in addition to the Filipinos themselves, had an interest in the Philippines. Filipino freedom fighters, led by Emilio Aguinaldo, had been brought by Dewey from Hong Kong to help liberate the Philippines. Aguinaldo's 10,000 insurgents had helped to capture Manila. Under other circumstances, it is highly likely the United States would have washed its hands of the Philippines and hastily departed. By 1898, however, there were other considerations. Roosevelt, Alfred Thayer Mahan, and others had already started to push the United States onto the world stage, and as a world power, the nation needed overseas coaling stations. With the annexation of Hawaii in July, the Philippines suddenly became a logical extension of American naval bases. Combined with the presence of British and German fleets, the fate of the Philippines as an American protectorate was sealed. Britain and Germany both had fleets in the region. Germany, in particular, thought little of the United States, saying, "God favored drunkards, fools, and the United States of America." Either nation could have controlled the Philippines the moment the American fleet left, although whether they would have fought each other is conjecture. At any rate, McKinley explained his reasoning as follows. "One night it came to me this way. One, we could not give them, the Philippines, back to Spain. That would be cowardly and dishonorable. Two, that we could not turn them over to France or Germany, our commercial rivals in the Orient. That would be bad business and discreditable. Three, that we could not leave them to themselves. They were unfit for self-government, and they would soon have anarchy and misrule over there worse than Spain's was. And four, that there was nothing left for us to do but to take them all and to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them." The last point, although it played a minor part in the president's decision, had been on the minds of Protestant Americans, whose missionary societies had sent many evangelists to the islands. Methodists in particular wrote of saving the little brown brother. Some historians dismiss these expressions of concern for the Filipinos as insincere excuses for national economic expansion. But, as usual, they ignore the genuine doctrinal commitment of most Christian groups to evangelize. McKinley realized that the choice he faced was not whether to liberate the islands, but which of three nations, the United States, Germany, or Britain, would control them. Predictably, when the Stars and Stripes went up in Manila, sending the European fleets packing, it ensured a response from the 80,000 Filipinos under Aguinaldo, who felt betrayed. An insurrection ensued, and for a year and a half, a guerrilla war of brutal proportions witnessed both sides engaging in torture and atrocities. McKinley, aware that the occupation required the support of the Filipino people, persuaded William Howard Taft to lead a 5-man commission to Manila in April 1900. Taft, who liked the Filipinos, earned their respect and soon produced reasonable, concrete steps to reduce opposition. McKinley's policy opened the door to anti-imperialists such as William Jennings Bryan, the Populists, and the Anti-Imperialist League. League members handed out leaflets to soldiers in the Philippines, urging them not to re-enlist. Some of the more extreme members of the League compared McKinley to a mass murderer and issued wild predictions that 8,000 Americans would die trying to hold the islands. Aguinaldo, like Ho Chi Minh and Osama bin Laden after him, knew he could not defeat the American military, so he turned to sour Americans on the war and ensure the victory of the anti-imperialist William Jennings Bryan in the election of 1900. The insurgents had the right target, American political willpower, but misjudged the resolve of the United States. Aguinaldo himself remained elusive despite unceasing American attempts to locate and capture him. Finally, with the assistance of an anti-insurrectionist Filipino group called the Maccabees, Aguinaldo was captured, and in April 1901, he swore an oath of allegiance to the United States. 3 months later, the military government ended, replaced by a provincial government under Taft. The islands remained U.S. possessions until World War II, although in 1916, the Jones Act announced American intentions to grant Philippine independence as soon as practicable. In 1934, the Tidings-McDuffie Act provided a tutelage period of 10 more years, setting the date for independence as 1944, and providing an election in which Manuel Quezon became the first president of the Philippines. Although Japanese occupation of the islands delayed independence beyond the 1944 target, in 1946, the United States granted independence to the Philippines on the 4th of July, once again proving wrong the critics of America who saw imperial interests as the reason for overseas expansion. Never before in history had a nation so willingly and, in general, so peacefully rescinded control over so much territory and so many conquered people as in the case of the possessions taken in the Spanish-American War. The Full Dinner Pail and Assassination. Not long after the war ended, Vice President Garrett A. Hobart died in office. McKinley and the Republicans knew they might have a popular replacement in Teddy Roosevelt, who had recently been elected governor of New York. McKinley had met Roosevelt when he went to Montauk to congratulate General Shafter and his troops. When the president saw Roosevelt, he stopped the carriage and extended his hand. The ebullient Roosevelt struggled to pull his glove off, finally grabbing it in his teeth before pumping McKinley's hand. Thus, with Hobart out, the Republicans approached Roosevelt, who really wanted no job save the president's, to replace the deceased vice president. Political realities, however, created an inexorable momentum toward the vice presidential nomination. As Boss Platt quipped, "Roosevelt might as well stand under Niagara Falls and try to spit water back as to stop his nomination by this convention." With Teddy on the ballot, a good economy, and the conclusion of a successful war, McKinley was unbeatable. His slogan, "A Full Dinner Pail," spoke to the economic well-being of millions without committing the government to engage in specific action. McKinley beat the Democrat William Jennings Bryan worse than he had in 1896, winning the popular vote 7.2 million to 6.3 million, and taking the electoral vote 292 to 155. While McKinley looked forward to serving as president of the whole people, Roosevelt committed himself to being a dignified non-entity for 4 years. The president had undertaken few new programs, aside from turning the Northern Security Trust issue over to Roosevelt to handle, when he made a trip to the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo on September 6, 1901. Just as a premonition of disaster had gripped many around Lincoln in his final days, so too did McKinley's staff grow increasingly uneasy as he headed to Buffalo. Several crank letters threatening assassination had arrived during the campaign, but McKinley dismissed them. The threats, however, alarmed his private secretary, George Cortelyou, who on his own started a screening process for visitors. In addition, a private investigator dogged the president's steps, and Buffalo police were on alert. McKinley refused to allow his aides to seal him off from the public, thus agreeing to a long reception line at one of the exposition buildings, the Music Temple. While a line of well-wishers streamed into a Bach organ sonata, Leon Czolgosz, the anarchist assassin, joined them, concealing a pistol in his bandaged right hand. As McKinley shook the man's left hand, Czolgosz shot the president twice. The stricken major slumped backward to a chair, urging Cortelyou to be careful, how he informed Mrs. McKinley her husband was dead. In fact, he remained alive, unconscious. A bullet had gone through his stomach and into his back. Efforts to locate it failed, despite the presence at the exposition of a new X-ray machine which was not used. Doctors cleansed and closed the wound without extracting the bullet. Over the next few days, McKinley regained consciousness, giving everyone around him hope, but he drifted away a week after the attack. New York City papers, which had earlier published editorials calling for McKinley's removal, Hearst had even said, "Assassination can be a good thing," engaged in finger-pointing as to whether the press should share blame in the president's death. McKinley became the third president in 35 years to be killed by an assassin, and for the first time both a president and a vice president from the same administration, 1896 to 1900, died in office. His killer, who wanted to cause all government to collapse, only succeeded in replacing a successful president with a legendary one. A brilliant madman born a century too soon. By 1907, Theodore Roosevelt, he hated the sobriquet Teddy, and although resigned to it, allowed none to call him that in person, stood 5 feet 8 inches tall and weighed 200 pounds, mostly muscle. His heavyweight sparring partner described him as a strong, tough man, hard to hurt and harder to stop. It was a remarkable transformation for the skinny kid who had entered Harvard in the mid-1870s. Yet for such a powerful man, he was small-boned with delicate feet and hands that contrasted with the heavy girth and jowls. His famous teeth, not as prominent as the caricatures, lent a distinctiveness to his speech, which was clipped and raspy and likened to a man biting tenpenny nails. Roosevelt's pronunciation added another distinguishing tone to his speech, wherein he pronounced I as I and punctuated his sentences with his favorite word, delighted. Albany legislators had made legend his habit of running up to the podium, waving a finger and shouting, "Mr. Speaker!" Asthmatic and bespectacled with his famous pince-nez, Roosevelt was a swirl of energy. He burst into rooms, descending on friends and foes like a thunderstorm, leading English writer John Morley to call Niagara Falls and Theodore Roosevelt great works of nature. Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula, once meeting Roosevelt, noted in his diary, "Must be president someday. A man you can't cajole, can't frighten, can't buy." Long before he became president, Roosevelt impressed people with his sharp mind and his ability to discuss intelligently almost any subject. His entrance exams at Harvard testified to his mental capacities. Obsessed with reading, he referred to it as a disease with him, Roosevelt had consumed such mammoth tomes as David Livingston's Missionary Travels. Well-traveled in Europe, Africa, and America, Roosevelt marveled at the written word as much as at the visual image. A frail child, Roosevelt spent summers working out and boxing as a means to build his body. He boxed during his Harvard years, but just as often he fought outside the ring, often decking political rivals who made fun of him. The intellectual Roosevelt, however, could penetrate to the heart of intricate legislative matters, often offending everyone in the process of doing the right thing. He spearheaded several municipal reform bills, nearly pulling off an investigation of New York corruption before witnesses developed memory loss. New York Assemblyman Newton Curtis called him a brilliant madman born a century too soon. Having overcome asthma, poor eyesight, and his own impetuous moods, Roosevelt was struck by sudden and nearly unbearable grief in February 1884, when his wife died after giving birth only a few hours after Roosevelt's mother, who had been in the same house, expired of typhoid fever. "There is a curse on this house," his brother Elliot had told him, and Roosevelt began to believe it. That curse would claim the alcoholic Elliot in 1891 when he had to be committed to an asylum. To drown his grief after his wife's death, the hyper Roosevelt left politics for his cattle ranch in Elkhorn, North Dakota, where he served as a deputy sheriff and helped track down a trio of horse thieves. Then, in 1889, after he was appointed by President Harrison to the Civil Service Commission, he returned to New York, where he developed a feud with former New York Governor Grover Cleveland. as in the case of the bitter antagonism between Adams and Jefferson, Jefferson and Hamilton, and Sherman and Lincoln, the Cleveland-Roosevelt feud, lopsided in Cleveland's favor as it was regrettable. Here was another example of two figures of towering character and, in many instances, clear vision, disagreeing over the proper implementation of their ideals. Yet such debates refined American democracy and were of no small import. Even before his appointment to the Civil Service Commission, Roosevelt had started to develop a national name with his authorship of books in the West, including Hunting Trips, 1885, and The Winning of the West, 1889, as well as 10 other works. While far from an inexorable march to the presidency, Roosevelt's steps seemed measured by a certain sense of relentlessness or providence. He entered New York City politics as police commissioner, a position that called for him to walk the slums and meet with future muckraker Lincoln Steffens and a police reporter named Jacob Riis. Roosevelt fit right in with the two men. Riis soon gravitated from his job with the New York Tribune to work on housing reform, which was the basis for his popular book, How the Other Half Lives, 1890. Steffens, whose wealthy father had instructed him to stay in New York and hustle, instead also became a reporter, but with the New York Evening Post. Roosevelt took Steffens seriously enough to initiate legislation based on his writings, although Roosevelt was dead by the time Steffens visited the Soviet Union in 1921 and uttered the preposterous comment, "I have seen the future and it works." Even as a young state assemblyman in the 1880s, Roosevelt was consumed by reform in his public career. His progressivism embraced an activist government to alleviate social ills. For many reformers, words like ethics and phrases about uplifting the masses were only so much window dressing for their real agenda of social architecture. Not Roosevelt. He genuinely believed that no people were ever benefited by riches if their prosperity corrupted their virtue. It is, he added, more important that we should show ourselves honest, brave, truthful, and intelligent than we should own all the railways and grain elevators in the world. Roosevelt came from old money, and despite such sentiment, he never entirely lost his patrician biases. This, in part, explains his antipathy toward corporations, most of whose founders came from new money. Rockefeller and Carnegie were self-made men who had built their fortunes the hard way. Roosevelt could never be accused of being afraid to dirty his hands, but his animosity toward businessmen like Edward H. Harriman suggested that in some ways he envied the corporate captains who had worked their way up from the bottom. His only flirtation with business came from his cattle ranch, where he squandered 20% of his fortune while he hunted and explored rather than tending to business. To have never had the opportunity to succeed in business troubled Roosevelt. It was all the more paradoxical coming from the man whose classic "Man in the Arena" speech still retains its wisdom and dignity. It is not the critic who counts, nor the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again because there is no effort without error or shortcoming, but who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself for a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least he fails with daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who knew neither victory nor defeat. Roosevelt had succeeded at everything he ever attempted, improving his physical strength and athletic prowess, courting and winning his wife, leading men in combat and running for office. By the time he became president then, Theodore Roosevelt had prepared himself for the office in every aspect necessary to the job, save one: understanding capitalism, private enterprise, and the industrial nature of modern America. For someone steeped in the romantic images of the West, Roosevelt should have favored the rugged individualism of a Carnegie, but his reform impulse possessed him. As a result, he became the most activist president since Andrew Jackson, doing more to impede business than any president since Old Hickory. Trust busting, business bashing. An indication of where Roosevelt planned to go with his agenda of corporate regulation could be gleaned from his brief stint as New York governor, where he pushed through a measure taxing corporations. A social Darwinist, Roosevelt liked the notion that there existed an intellectual hierarchy among men, and that only the best and the brightest should lead. This same Roosevelt fancied himself the friend of the oppressed, and thought farmers, mechanics, and small business owners were his natural allies. But in Roosevelt's mind, if the brilliant individual or the visionary man knew best how to reform society, he should do so with whatever tools he had at his disposal, including government. Consequently, it surprised no one who knew him that Roosevelt favored an activist federal presence. William Howard Taft said that he never met a man more strongly in favor of strong government than Roosevelt. In his first inaugural, Roosevelt spoke favorably of great corporations and endorsed the idea of expanding markets. To this, he added that trusts had gone beyond the capacity of existing laws to deal with them, and that old laws and traditions could not sufficiently contain concentrations of wealth and power. Congress sensed the change, passing the Elkins Act in 1903, which prohibited railroads from giving rebates, essentially volume discounts, to large corporations. The notion that businesses were different from individual behavior or needed to be penalized for success beyond what was reasonable was a progressive principle that soon emerged in many regulations. Epitomizing the direction of Roosevelt's new policies was the Northern Securities suit of 1902. This followed a legal ruling in the E.C. Knight sugar refiner case of 1895, where the Supreme Court declared the regulation of manufacturing a state responsibility. Since the manufacturing was within a state's boundaries, any successful suit had to involve interstate commerce. Since Northern Securities involved railroads crossing state lines, it met the requirements. Roosevelt thought he had an opening and instructed the Attorney General, Philander C. Knox, to file a Sherman antitrust suit against Northern Securities, a holding company for the Northern Pacific, Great Northern, and Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy railroads. J.P. Morgan, James J. Hill, E.H. Harriman, and representatives of Standard Oil Company